Okay. Now, the subject of this essay is chinuch banim, you know, the education of children. And the interesting thing about Parsha Shmos is that it begins a series of parshios that we're going to read in the Torah that are called by the Rishonim already, going back to the early days, 1,000 years ago, Shovavim Tat. And if you take a look at the shin of Shovavim, you'll see that it corresponds to Shmos, and then the Vav corresponds to Va'era, and this goes on and on. Each letter corresponds to another word that begins the Parsha, and finally we get to the last Tav, which is Tetzave. And basically, if you count the number of letters here in Shovavim Tat, you'll come to the number 7. And these are 7 weeks that are dedicated to Tshuva, because the Pasuk says, Shuvu Bonim Shovavim. The Navi calls upon the wild or mischievous children to come back and to do Tshuva, to repent. So that's during this period of time for 7 weeks. And we're going to try to figure out why this period of time is designated for Tshuva. What's the relationship between these 7 weeks and any other period of time during the course of the year? I mean, obviously, we're familiar with Tshuva during Rosh Chodesh El, you know, from Rosh Chodesh El until Yom HaKippurim, during that period of 5 weeks or so. But why this period of time? And the answer is that the Rishonim find in every one of these 7 parashios some sort of indication of tshuva, of repentance. And we're going to soon see how these parashas indicate tshuva, but the point is that when we read a parasha of the Torah, it's not just coincidental, because that parasha came out to be in the Jewish, you know, in the Hebrew calendar that week, but rather there's an integral connection between the parasha and its content and that period of time. And if we have 7 parashios which consistently, you know, every single parasha of these 7 indicates tshuva, then it must be that this is bridging a period of time which is designated for tshuva. And the pasuk that we're dealing with is Shuvu Banim Shovavim. And the word banim, you know, children or sons, usually refers to the younger generation. And it's the responsibility of the parents to raise that generation, to educate them, and guide them in the right path. I remember when I was a kid, there used to be a television program that started with news at 10 o'clock at night. And they used to, every night it started, it is 10 p.m., do you know where your children are? You remember that?
Channel 5.
That's right, because, you know, people in our generation, they raise children, they don't even know where they are, you know. I'm just going to make a bracha. Okay. Now, no doubt, the central figure in our parasha, in Shmos, and for many parashios to come, is Moshe Rabbeinu. He becomes the image of the persona that's so significant. Everything seems to revolve around him. And here in Sefer Shmos, for the first time, Moshe Rabbeinu receives this kind of crown of glory. It's the first time in the history of Klal Yisrael that we have an official leader of the entire nation. And until now, we had the Avos, we had the Imahos, we had the Shvatim. Yehuda played a major role, Yosef played a leadership role, but they were still the heads of families. They weren't the heads of a nation, because for the Jewish nation, nationhood emerges when the Jews are redeemed from Mitzrayim. And the leader who's taking them and redeeming them from Mitzrayim is, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu in this week's parasha is being appointed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the leader of Am Yisrael, of a nation, not just the head of a family or a shevet, but the entire nation. And this leads us to the Gemara in Sota. You know, the Gemara in Sota is very, very full of Haggadah. And one particular Haggadah, which is on Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis, interprets a pasuk. It says, with regard to Miriam, you remember Miriam is Moshe's older sister, and when Moshe is in the cradle and is floating down the Nile River, she, Miriam, goes over to Bas Paro, which Chazal identify as Batya, and asks her the question, Ha'elech, should I go v'karasilach, and I will call on your behalf someone, Isha Meinekes Mina Ivrios, one of the Jewish women, to nurse the child? And why was it necessary, from the perspective of Batya Bas Paro, to find a Jewish woman to nurse this baby? Obviously, Batya wanted to raise this child as her own. Couldn't she find some sort of Egyptian woman who could serve that role and nurse the baby? So the Gemara in Sota says, Malami, this is meant to teach us, Shechziru lemosha al kol ha-mitzios kulan v'lo yonak, that they tried all different women amongst the Egyptian ladies, and Moshe, this little tot, this little newborn baby, refused to nurse from any of them. And why is that so? So the Gemara tells us a very famous principle that Pesha Asid L'Dar Mashchina, the mouth which in the future would be speaking to God, meaning the mouth of Moshe Rabbeinu, because you know Moshe, as opposed to all the other prophets, has this direct communication, a dialogue with Hashem. So that organ of the body in which Moshe is going to address Kaviyachol the Shechina is going to be the mouth. Is Yinak Midover Tame? Can he nurse from something which is contaminated, which is repulsive? V'hainu Dechsiv, and that's what it says. Esmi Yoredeyav, Esmi Yovin Shmua. This is a pasuk in Tanakh. Yeshayahu Anovi says, who is the one who's knowledgeable? Who is the one who understands a Shmua means a tradition, a transmission of Torah? Gmule Mecholav Atike Mishadayim. Those who are weaned from the milk of Atike Shamayim. We have to, Mishadim. Shadim means the breast, right? And Atike, that word has a lot of meaning to it. Atike, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself is called in the Zohar, the Atik Yomim, which means the ancient one. Not old, but ancient. And this pasuk serves as a source for the fact that someone who will have knowledge, and we're talking about knowledge of Torah, of the divine wisdom, and somebody who would comprehend the tradition of Torah as it's transmitted, is got to be someone who drank the milk of Atike, of the ancient ones, meaning from a Jewish person who has an ancient tradition and a connection back to the Ribono Shel Olam. Now the amazing thing is that this statement in the Gemara in Sota is simply what we'd call an agadata. You know, agadata usually means a message, a thought, an interpretation, an inspiration, but it's not brought down la'aloch. It doesn't usually have the validity of law. There are different parts of Gemara. You know, there's halachic parts and there's agadic parts. But yet, in this case, Rav Yosef Cairo in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah following suit actually codifies this medrash in the Gemara in Sota la'alocha. And this is in Yoredei Siman Pei Aleph. And it says, Lo yaniku tinok minakusis. We should be inhibited about allowing a Jewish child to nurse from a non-Jewish mother. Im efshar b'Yisraelus. Unless it's impossible. But as long as we have an alternative, we have a Jewish woman, we have to give preference to a Jewish woman. Why? The cholav kusis mitamtem halev. What does that mean, mitamtem halev? That's a spiritual kind of concept. It has the milk of a non-Jewish woman has a negative impact on the heart of the child. Again, this is not something that you can explain biologically or tested in the laboratory. Obviously not. But this, whenever we have any contact in all of Jewish writings with what we call non-kosher food, forbidden food, or we can call it macholas asuras, it's always metamte malev. You know, somehow the non-kosher food has an impact on the soul itself, on the spiritual makeup of a person. And the source for this halacha of the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, is our Gemara here that we're studying, the Agadat in Sota, regarding Moshe Rabbeinu. that just like Moshe Rabbeinu would refuse to nurse from the Egyptian women, so too we should avoid allowing a Jewish child to nurse from a non-Jewish mother. And the Achronim will ask the following question. Wait a minute. The Gemara in Sota gives an explanation. Why is it that Moshe would not be okay with nursing from a Mitzri woman? The answer is because he's Pasha Asid L'daber Mashchina. He's the mouth that's going to speak to the Shechina in a direct communication. Now, when I raise a Jewish child, why should I make this equation, this analogy to Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore prohibit the child from nursing from a non-Jewish woman? He's not Pesha Asid L'daber Mashchina. He's not the future, the mouth that's going to speak to the Shechina. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. That's a singular, unique halacha in Moshe Rabbeinu. It doesn't have any application to a regular Jewish child. And perhaps the answer is that we have to raise every Jewish child, and this I heard in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, with the potential to reach the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Meaning we cannot close the door and set up barriers that would make it impossible for this child to reach that level. We don't know how great this child might be. Again, it would be one in a billion, one in a trillion, but it doesn't matter. Every Jewish child has to be seen, has to be perceived as a potential Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, we are obligated with regard to every single Yeled B'Yisrael. And this is an obligation that's specifically incumbent upon the parents to make sure, even in the youth of the child, in the infancy, that nothing should be brought into the child's mouth that might be metamteh mesalev and might present a barrier inhibiting the child down the line from speaking to the Shechina. So we're beginning to see a very basic lesson in education, that when you look at a child and a parent thinks, okay, what is the potential for the child? To imagine the ultimate potential, the infinite potential of becoming a Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, let's go on and back to Miriam. Miriam comes to Bas Paro, to Batya, and she presents Bas Paro with a proposal. She says, you know what, I have a good woman amongst the Ivrios, amongst the Hebrew women that could serve this role, this capacity to nurse this baby that you found, you know, in the cradle on the Nile. Now, at this point, this is a pretty dangerous step on the part of Miriam. Why? Because if you take a look, she is really giving over the baby. Well, actually, there are two sides to this coin. I mean, who's actually taking a dangerous step here? On the one hand, it's Miriam, because she's stepping forward and saying, let's bring over one of the Hebrew women. But on the other hand, we cannot, you know, de-emphasize the significance of Bas Paro over here. You know, the law in Egypt was very strict and the punishment would be very severe. And now, what's going to happen is that a Jewish male child is going to be given over, if Bas Paro agrees to the plan, to one of the Hebrew mothers. That's a capital crime. And the Mefarshim, the commentaries, bring a proof from here that Miriam was a prophetess, and she knew that Bas Paro would do whatever she could to protect this child. So again, if you look at this scenario and this episode from the perspective of what we call the natural law, certainly Miriam was putting her life in danger over here. But since Miriam was an Aviyah, from the perspective of a prophecy that she received, that Bas Paro, the daughter of Paro, would take good care of the child, then she was secure, she was comfortable with the fact that her brother, the little baby, would be in secure hands. Now, in the case of the baby itself is now 3 months old. And imagine a baby of 3 months old that refuses to nurse from the Egyptians. You know, that also is Mesiris Nefesh. again, it's only a baby, but think about it. Moshe Rabbeinu, at the age of 3 months, is already putting his life into danger because without nursing, he's going to perish. And he doesn't have any guarantee that, you know, at the end of the day, they will permit a Jewish woman to come forward and be medic and nurse it. So we're looking at a household that's made up of the following members. Number one, we have Miriam. She's putting her life, you know, life on the line because this is not something that's permissible. The baby is putting his life on the line. The adoptive mother, that's, you know, Bati Bas Paro, she herself is putting her life on the line. And with everyone around this family willing to put their lives into danger, you know, we can begin to understand how a Moshe Rabbeinu comes out of such a household, you know, a leader of the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. If all the people in his life, you know, he says, you know, a Jewish mother always has to remember, you know, that when she's nursing a baby, that she should do the best, you know, the best job that she can, and not allow for that baby to nurse from a non-Jewish mother, a non-Jewish woman, because she has to really follow in the footsteps of Moshe and all those who surrounded Moshe to see to it that Moshe would grow to be the great leader. And that's how a mother has to treat her child. So it's an amazing thing when a woman nurses a baby. And of course, there's a lot of emotion and a closeness, and that's how she connects to the baby. But from a Jewish perspective, there's another dimension that we have to add. Raise this child, fulfill your obligation in such a way that this child might be the great leader of Klal Yisrael like Moshe Rabbeinu. That's as far as the Gemara in Sotah is concerned. Now we want to look at a Gemara in Chagiga on Daf Tesvav. The Gemara tells us about Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya was a great Tana. He actually was the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir, the great Rabbi Meir. And at the end, Elisha ben Avuya goes what we call today, I think the colloquial is off the derech, if you're familiar with that phrase. In Hebrew it's called Litarbus Ra. And the Gemara tells us in Chagiga about Elisha ben Avuya that Achar Kitzetz Benetios, that he witnessed a terrible tragedy, and as a result, he became a kofer. You know, he denied, he became a scoffer. That's called kitzetz benetios, which literally means that he cut down a sapling. Sapling is representative symbolically of emunah, and he cut down the emunah. All of Akosif Omer, with regard to Elisha ben Avuya, the pasuk says, Al titein espicha lachti espsorecha. That he allowed his mouth to, so to speak, violate in a criminal way his entire being. And at this point, the Gemara goes on to tell us that when Elisha ben Avuya violated all of the Torah, a baskol came out of Shamayim and declared, Shuvu banim shuvavim, Shovavim Chutzme Acher. That's what Elisha ben Avuya heard. He heard this divine voice, divine sound, declaring that everyone could come back to tshuva with the exception of Elisha. Elisha had crossed all the red lines and came to the conclusion, based on this baskel, that he has no chance, no shot at doing tshuva. And Omar, he declared, "Hol v'itrid ahu gavra mehu alma." He says, if that person, he's referring to himself in third person, has been completely excluded from the world to come, then leipuk, let him go out, lishani, and have a good time, b'hai alma, and enjoy this world. Is nafik acher tarbus ra'? He figured, if that be the case, you know, let me dedicate myself to all the pleasures of life. So Tosus there in Masechet Chagiga brings a number of different opinions to explain what caused Elisha to go so low. And one of the opinions is Rabbi Nosson. Rabbi Nosson says, "Kshahoisa ima muberes," when Elisha was in a fetal state, "Avra lifnei avodah zara," his mother, pregnant mother, went by, passed by an avodah zara, and they were burning incense for the idols, and all the fires and the smoke was going up. "Veheiricha," and she smelled the beautiful smell, "meosad min," of one particular food that they were burning, "veachla," and she was so overwhelmed by the smell, it was so enticing, that she ate from that min, and "vahaya oso hamin," and that food within her body, "mizazea begufa," it was shaking around in her body, it was, you know, her body was literally trembling like an earthquake, "ka'achna," like a serpent that was penetrating into our kishkes, our insides. Now, if you think about it, according to Rav Nosson, Elisha ben Avuya is not in any way deliberate or guilty of throwing away the Torah. He only did it because his mother had imbibed, you know, something that was prohibited. And if that be the case, he's guiltless. And we have a principle in halacha, onus rachmana patri. The Torah never finds a person guilty when there are mitigating circumstances beyond his control. Now, what happened was, she, the mother, passed by Avodah Zarah. The smell of the Avodah Zarah went into her nostrils. And there's no reason why the child, the fetus, should be punished for that. What's going on over here? And the answer must be that at the moment that she smelled that beautiful smell, then the mother of Elisha was hivchira ha'em li'enos min areach. She decided that, you know, once this smell was so enticing, that she would deliberately and actively seek to enjoy the benefits of the smell. Lehenos min areach, that would be one possibility. Or she could have overcome that smell and decided in her mind that this is disgusting, this is repulsive, I don't want to know anything, I don't want to have any connection to this smell. But you know what? She decided that, look, the smell came into her nostrils without her will, you know, it wasn't that she actively tried to smell it. It was actually compelled upon her, it was forced upon her. And therefore, there's no reason that she should feel inhibited from enjoying the benefit of that smell. So it's very interesting. There is a principle called onus rachmana patri, that the Torah finds you guiltless of something that you didn't seek, but it was imposed upon you. But there's a limit to that. And the limit is that if at some point, even though initially you were honest, you decided actively to enjoy, you know, the sin, so to speak, the criminal act, then you can no longer claim honest. You know, I was. It was forced upon me. So in other words, at that very moment that she made the decision to enjoy the benefits of the Reach, that entered into her body, that smell, like a poison, and it even had an impact on the child, on the fetus itself. Again, that impact is, it's going to take years and years until finally it's going to do its damage, and the, you know, the damaging, the spiritually damaging power of that food is going to impact on the soul of this individual, in which ultimately Elisha ben Avuya, many, many decades later, is going to drop it as far as spirituality and a commitment to Torah. He's going to become Acher. Acher means he's the on the outside. But we see again, getting back to the concept called Timtum Alev, which we saw by Moshe Rabbeinu, that the Gemara tells us in Sota that he wouldn't drink the milk of a non-Jewish woman because it's Machtamtem Es Alev, meaning it enters, it penetrates into the heart, and it could have an impact way, way down the line. It's not something that's immediate. It's not like when you eat something that's, you know, that's poisonous or detrimental to your health, immediately you feel sick. Not so in the case of this very subtle and spiritual impact of a of a violation of Machalas Asuros. And even the Ubar, even the fetus in its mother's womb, that it didn't, you know, Shalobe Machal Asur Mamish, you know, even Avodah Zorah, which again you're not allowed to have benefits from, but here what went into a body, only the reach, only the smell of the Avodah Zorah, even that could have such an impact on the fetus. So again, when we come back to the concept that we began with, that there's a tremendous, awesome responsibility on the parents to educate the child, and we saw that that means that, you know, you're not allowed to give your child over to a non-Jewish nurse from a non-Jewish woman. But even more than that, to get a concept, you know, to begin to understand how different influences can impact on the child, such subtle things, like in this case, reach, the smell of Avodah Zorah, and years down the line, it's going to have an impact. Now, there's another source with regard to Elisha ben Avuya, and that's the Hagos Ashri, which are comments on the Rosh, in Masechta Avodah Zorah. What caused Elisha ben Avuya to go down, down, down? He says that Elisha's mother was not careful with Macholas Asuros, with forbidden non-kosher food. Not like we saw earlier, that the problem was that she smelled the Avodah Zorah, right? That was the Gemara in Chagiga. But rather, the fact that she actually was careless with regard to non-kosher food. And he says the following: whichever source you want to take, whether it's the Gemara in Chagiga, whether it's Hagos Ashri in Avodah Zorah, we see two sources that indicate the very great severity and the responsibility to be so meticulous about a child, to make sure that the spiritual makeup of the child is not ill affected, it's not damaged, because that could have an impact years later. And on the flip side of it, to see the extreme care of Miriam and Moshe to avoid any sort of nursing from a non-Jewish source, that's going to bring Moshe to that level, that very high level of being the master of all prophets. Now, at this point in his presentation, the Hamer Yenachamuni tells us a story about one of the Hasidic Rebbes in Eretz Yisrael. And the tragic part of the story is that this Rebbe had a daughter who rebelled against her father, and she decided that she wants to join a secular kibbutz and live there. And what happened was, she was completely swept away by what we call the chalutziyut. Chalutziyut means, you know, the first, what do they call them?
Pioneers.
The pioneers, you know, of the Zionist movement. And at that point, you know, when the State of Israel was being established, that the Ruach, you know, the powerful force of the young Zionists was, you know, took souls, you know, it really won, you know, it won the hearts of the youth. And not only that, there was the ideology of the kibbutz as a socialist ideology, that everyone's equal and there are no poor people and we treat everyone the same way. That just went into our heart, and it just conquered, it ruled over our heart. And of course, the father, who's imagine a Hasidic Rebbe, he saw that there was no way that he could put his foot in her path, and she had made such a definite decision. So he asked her for one request. He said, look, I can't compel you to live my lifestyle, but I'm going to ask you for one thing. When the day comes that you'll get married, will you please observe the laws of Taras HaMishpacha? I mean, that's a great thing to ask of a woman who's not religious. And he goes on to say, you'll ask me what justifies such a request. After all, this is a tremendous imposition on you. And he says the following: you know what? You came to the conclusion of chaya v'tein lichios, that let live and let live, that everybody has the right, the freedom of choice, to choose their path in life. However, if you will not observe the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, then you're going to prevent your children from the possibility of being able to choose their path. In other words, by violating the laws of Nida, of Taras HaMishpacha, Mikveh, and so forth, you will have closed the doors in front of your children from the possibility of their choosing on their own, with their own free will, which path they want to take. Because if these children of yours will ever want to go back to the original source, you know, the original influence of grandparents, they will be considered pugumim, because pugumim, I'm going to try to explain that word, because their mother was not careful about the laws of mikveh. And what is a pugumim? Again, it's very hard, the word to describe. Literally, it means blemished. It means some sort of deficiency. If the child is born from a state of nida, then that child has a certain pagam. And therefore, you're really making it almost impossible for that child to choose the right path. So you know what? When the Rebbe said these words with such, you know, touching and sincere, genuine feelings, she was overwhelmed by it. And she took it upon herself that even in the kibbutz, which was a totally secular kibbutz, she would observe the laws of Taras HaMishpacha. And according to the tradition, again, I can't vouch for it, the story goes that she gave birth to children, and they went back to their grandfather's way, they did tshuva, and all this is because of the fact that she kept up the mikveh laws. Mm-hmm. Now again, what I find a little difficult about understanding and accepting the story is that how was she able to marry, you know, let's say she married a kibbutznik or a secular Jew, she's living in a secular kibbutz. I just don't understand the practice of it, the practicality of it. How is it possible for her to implement the laws of Taras HaMishpacha? I mean, that's really kind of amazing, unbelievable. He says that they did a study of preemies that were born prematurely, and they studied them during the first month of their life while they were still in an incubation state. And during this this scientific study, they divided up the babies, the preemies, into two groups. One group had parents who wanted to visit them, visit the incubation three times a day. That's what they were allowed to do. And to try to connect to the baby even while the baby is in an incubation period, which is very difficult to do. They tried to smile for the baby. They tried to, in any way, communicate with the baby, speak to the baby. The second group was a group made up of parents who refused to have any connection. They don't even want to come in to visit their preemie, because a child in an incubation period is not aware of anything. So why should we bother coming in? They didn't bother trying to create any connection on a daily basis with their children, with their babies. And at the end of the study, which they followed for a number of years, they found that the children that received, even in incubation period, warmth and love during that month of incubation, turned out that they had a much more calm and a complacent childhood, and they had a definite warm connection, much more with their a connection with their parents that was greater than the children who were left, you know, loveless, so to speak, during the first month. Mm-hmm. Now again, I would assume that somehow, if this was a bona fide scientific experiment, that they also took into consideration that the parents are of a different, these two sets of parents are of a different ilk, and that would have an impact even down the line. You know, here they're putting all the emphasis on the incubation period. In any event, what they tried to prove through this study is that already on the first month in the child's life, there is a tremendous significance for warmth and love that can impact on the child. And this is something which we saw in Chazal, that already, you know, already at, in terms of the nursing period, it's so significant of how much an impact it could have on the child, or the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu did not, you know, he's 3 months old and yet he doesn't want to nurse from a non-Jewish source. And this reminds us, of course, of the Gemara in Masechta Ksuvos. The Gemara says that at the Yamsuf, even the fetus in its mother's womb sang a song of praise to Hashem. So we don't give the fetus, you know, enough significance for the neon lights. Okay, now we get back to our Parsha Shmos, and it says Vayivakesh Hashem Lamiso. You remember that Moshe Rabbeinu was l'chora guilty and negligent in not circumcising his sons, and Hashem wanted to take his life. So it means if you, Moshe Rabbeinu, are careless about the milah, about the bris milah of your son Eliezer, then you deserve to die. It's an unbelievable, harsh punishment. The Targum Yonasan ben Uziel says that Moshe Rabbeinu took an oath to Yisro, his father-in-law, before he married Zipporah. And what was the essence of that oath? And the answer is, At haben arishon, et haben arishon, lo yamul, v'yukdash lavodazah. It's mind-boggling. Yisro demands of Moshe Rabbeinu a commitment that his first son, who turns out to be Eliezer, should not be circumcised and should rather be dedicated to idol worship. The second son, which will be Gershon, then already you can circumcise it. And this is derived from the pasuk Vayoel Moshe Lasheves Es Ha'ish. And Moshe decided to sit to dwell or to live together with the man, meaning with Yisro. And the pasuk says, "Vayoel Moshe Lasheves Es Ha'ish." Just a second. He doesn't quote. Unfortunately, he doesn't quote the whole pasuk. But in any event, in that pasuk, it says Aleph Lamed Hey, which is Allah. Allah is a lashon of Shavuah. That Moshe Rabbeinu was demanded of Moshe Rabbeinu from his father-in-law that he take a shvuah to this effect. And the taina against Moshe Rabbeinu about not giving the bris was dafka against vis-a-vis Eliezer, not about Gershom. Gershom, Moshe Rabbeinu was not permitted to circumcised because of the shvuah, that he had to take a shvuah to Yisro. That's as far as Gershon is concerned. But as far as Eliezer is concerned, Moshe had no reason to procrastinate. Why did he delay the milah? So I'm a little bit confused. Let's just make sure we got the facts on the ground. It says here that according to the Targum Yonasan, Moshe Rabbeinu had to take a shvuah to Yisro that he would not circumcise his first son. Ah, so then Moshe Rabbeinu was bound by this oath not to circumcise his first son. And if that be the case, why is Moshe Rabbeinu being taken to task for procrastinating? For being negligent about that meal. He had already taken a shvuah. He had taken an oath. He was committed. So the Chizkuni, that's one of the Ashkenazi commentaries from the Rishonim on Chumash, he says, in the name of the Medrash, Be'etzem ha'onesh le'moshe kan, hoya kfar gam al gershon, v'ilue nisrashel v'eliezer lo'oysol of kol kpeda,
Ach beregeshe hishtah im biloso shel Eliezer is then there's going to be a claim against Moshe Rabbeinu even as far as Gershon is concerned. Again, the names here are a little bit confusing because first he says that the Taina against Moshe Rabbeinu was regarding Eliezer. And why is that so? Because with regard to Gershon, I may have switched the names, I'm sorry. That Gershon, because of the Shvuah that Moshe took to Yisro, it was impossible, he was enjoined Moshe Rabbeinu from circumcising Gershon. Then when we get to Eliezer, where there was no Shvuah, Moshe Rabbeinu had no justification for delaying the milah. And the Chizkuni brings a medrash here that the onish l'Moshe was even as far as Gershon is concerned. Even though, again, as far as Gershon is concerned, Moshe was bound by the oath. But once he delayed and he dilly-dallied with regard to the milah of Eliezer, then there's already a claim against Moshe Rabbeinu even as far as Gershon is concerned, because apparently the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was dilly-dallying with Mila and delaying that mitzvah is not because of the oath. If it was because of the oath, then why was he delaying in the case of Eliezer where there was no oath? For the fact that even in the case of Eliezer, Moshe Rabbeinu was not so keen and not so quick on implementing the Mila, that already sheds a light even as far as Gershon is concerned. That even as far as Gershon is concerned, apparently Moshe Rabbeinu would have procrastinated. It's not because of the Shvuah that he procrastinated. Now, in Parshas Korach, it says the following. Moshe declares, Lo chamor echad mehem nasasi, lo herosi es echad mehem. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I didn't steal anything from anyone. I never did any evil to anyone. So Rashi quotes the Tanchuma, Lo chamoro shel echad mehem natalti, afil kshalachti mi Midyan leMitzrayim, even when I had to go from Midyan all the way to Mitzrayim, verkavti es ishti ves bonai al hachamor, and I put my wife and the children onto a donkey, V'hoyli litol oso hachamor mishelahem lo natalti ela et sheli. In other words, at that point, Moshe Rabbeinu would have had a green light, he would have had permission to take anyone's chamor, because he had to get his family over to down to Mitzrayim from Midyan, but he didn't do so. Moshe Rabbeinu went beyond the letter of the law. He didn't take anybody's chamor. Now, the question is, this Tanchuma seems to assume that he, Moshe Rabbeinu, could have taken a chamor to ride on the chamor. Now, wait a second, he left Midyan on his way to Mitzrayim. How can he take anybody's chamor? I mean, the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim. Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, I never took a chamor from any Jew. Where were these chamorim? Where were these donkeys? So perhaps what the Tanchuma means is that afterwards, later on in history, Moshe Rabbeinu could have taken some sort of possession of Bnei Yisrael in order to pay for whatever he has to pay for, because everything he does is as a leader of Klal Yisrael. But perhaps what's being said here, and that's where he quotes Rav Menachem Mendel Mirivnov, that why was it so important to Moshe Rabbeinu not to take from Klal Yisrael anything? I never took anything, Moshe says. We find something similar in Shmuel Anovi. He also says, I never took anything from the people. And yet, Omer Abai, the Gemara says in the name of Abai, Vitei Rav Yitzchok, Harotze Lehenos, if a person wants to benefit from this world, is Yehenna Ke'alisha. He should have a benefit the way Elisha did. But she'eno rotzeleno, salyeno,
Kishmuel Haramasi. So we have two options over here. We could enjoy the benefit of a Talmud Chacham, and we do so only for the purpose of L'shem Shamayim, first of mitzvah, and that's the way Elisha did it. But even though Elisha was the one who received gifts as kind of a recognition or gratitude of for his services, nevertheless Shmuel went a step further. And Shmuel says, I don't want to take any benefits from Klal Yisrael, any gifts for any service that I perform, that I provide. Shenema, the Pasuk says, Utshuvasa Ramasa Kisham Beso, Om Rabbi Yochanan Bekol Mokom, Shaholach Sham Beso Ima. He didn't even allow them to, you know, when he was on the road, to invite them into his inn, you know, free of charge. But rather, he brought his tent with him. It was a collapsible tent, so he shouldn't benefit from anyone. In other words, there's a difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and Shmuel and Elisha Hanav. Right? Moshe and Shmuel, on one hand, don't want to benefit at all from anything that the people give him, but Elisha, on the other hand, will be willing to accept gifts. So this Hasidish Rebbe, Rav Mendel, he said the following. Moshe and Shmuel were functioning as leaders. Elisha was functioning as in the capacity of a prophet. He was the greatest saint and religious individual of his generation. But there's a fundamental difference between these two jobs. A manig, a leader of Israel, has a responsibility on his shoulders to be super duper careful not to allow anything, you know, that could be like a bribe, you know, it could be looked at as a gift for services from the people. He's got to be totally dedicated to guide the people without any sort of, you know, vested interest that he might have. And therefore, if he accepts gifts from the people, that might undermine his ability to function as a manig b'Yisrael, as a leader of Israel. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu is not like the situation of Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya is not holding public office. But anyone who serves as a leader and holds public office has to be super duper careful, go to the other extreme, Lizar Bioser, to make sure that he doesn't take something, gifts from the people, because otherwise when he leads the people, he'll be biased in one way or the other. Or the people will undermine or question his authority to judge them. And therefore he should have no benefits whatsoever. Tzaddik? Okay, every generation has a tzaddik. That tzaddik is in a different state. He's allowed, and he has merits, to be appointed by the tzibur of Klal Yisrael. So that's, you know, that's the tzaddik of Elisha. Elisha is the paradigm of a tzaddik, and if need be, in order to support himself, he is allowed to take, you know, contributions from the people. But when you get to a manhig, a leader, that's already something else. So let's just learn a little bit more, and then we'll finish. He says, now we can understand why it's so important that Moshe Rabbeinu, at the very beginning of his leadership, when he takes over the role as the Redeemer of Israel, he's got to send a message, a very important message, to his wife and his children. We're going out for shlichus, you know, as the agents, the first agents for the nation of Israel. And therefore, we're not going to take with us anything from the people. No gifts. We're not going to receive any gifts. We don't have a rechev, you know, he says, Eimon rechev, sagad el chamor ayashan vatov shalanu. He says, all we're going to take along with us is the chamor, this donkey who's reliable. And lo kibalti esaminu, I never accepted this office, this appointment, in order to get benefits from the people, but rather I want to dedicate my heart and soul, my body, my mind, everything should be for Avdus Hashem. Everything, every part of me is meshubad, is waved, is leaned, you know, for the sake of the benefit of Klal Yisrael. I'm not going to take anything from the people. And that's very critical, that Moshe Rabbeinu refuses to accept any gifts from the people. So
we didn't get a chance to finish this, but I think we covered most of it. And you know, I want to thank you. Thank
sure,
you so much.
Thank you. I was thinking.
The Gemara tells us about this Gemara about Basra Daf Kuf Yud about Yonasan, the son of Gershon, who's the son of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is Moshe Rabbeinu Zenekel, who was caught as a Komer Lavodah Zarah. He was actually helping out in the service of idol worship. And at that time, David HaMelech meets him and asks him, how is it possible that one of the offspring of Moshe Rabbeinu could possibly become a Komer Lavodah Zarah? And Yonasan answers, Kach Mekublani, I heard from my, you know, from base of the Abba, from the house of my grandfather, Liolam Yaskir, Adam Atzvola Vodazal, Yitztarach Lebrios. And what he understood from Moshe Rabbeinu was that if a person is in dire straits and he has no money wherewithal to support himself, rather than panhandle and collect stucca, he should be a Komer Lavodazara, Mamish Avodazara. And that's not what Moshe Rabbeinu had in mind. The Gemara explains that what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying was that he should take a service and dedicate himself to a job that's below his dignity, that's alien to him, like Avodah Zarah, rather than impose himself on the tzibur and collect tzedakah. Avodah Shezarah lo, that's the Gemara's language, and that's what Rav says to Rav Kahana. He tells him that if you don't have a livelihood, then go and strip the hides of an avail of a carcass and get paid for that. And don't say, well, I'm a Gavra Rabba, this is below my dignity. And Kevan Shara David Shemamon Chaviv Olav Biyosu, when David realized about this Yonasan ben Gershon ben Moshe, that he was so lahut, you know, he was so interested in money and getting more and more money, he decided he's going to appoint Yonasan ben Gershon to be the Mamuna, to be in charge of overseeing all the otzros, all the treasuries. And this is based on a pasuk, Shvuel ben Gershon ben Menashe Nagid ala Otzros. V'chi Shvuel shmo v'alo Yonasan shmo amalei Omer Rabbi Yochanan sheshav lekel b'chol libo. At the end, he did tshuva. In other words, David HaMelech understood that this fellow Yonasan misinterpreted what he heard from Moshe Rabbeinu, because that's what he heard what he wanted to hear. You know, he was so desperate for Mamon to, you know, to achieve financial success that he came to this misinterpretation and he misconstrued the words of Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, Yonasan could have actually understood his grandfather as saying that that it means an avodah zara, meaning zaralo, but he interpreted that way because he wanted to, meaning on a deeper level. That's what he had in mind. Okay, Rabosai, we'll stop here.